Okay, let's go ahead and get started.
So first off, I put up solutions for assignment one online, and assignment two is online. So you'll notice now there is a link here. Now, I haven't put the solutions to part A up. If you really want them, I will put them together. I started putting them together, and I realized, wait, these are really boring. You know, either you went through and did them and saw what happened or not. I mean, that's all you had to do, so... It's like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. But part B and C, the ones you actually had to think on, I did include them, and I'm happy to talk through some of these things, the interesting parts here. Then there's assignment two, which is up now, and I want to talk to you a little bit about assignment two. So, and then I want to talk about, so I saw the solutions. I want to talk a little about session management, and then I want to talk about eval, and then we'll talk about environments. So I'm kind of thinking that the environments and the scoping puzzles and stuff, we'll do that in the second half of the class. The first half of the class, we'll focus on talking about the assignments and the stuff. Sounds good? Any questions that are kind of on your mind first? Yes?
Are we going to be working on assignment two in the lab this week?
This Friday in lab? Basically what you did in the last week's, in the most recent assignment is part of assignment two already. So you're probably, normally what I like to do for this assignment, there'll be something that will contribute to your understanding of it, may help you with tools. So I haven't completely decided what you're all going to do. It might be, what I'd like to do if I have time is put together an authentication one which actually has you do like real authentication in a web application, but I'm not sure. I'm kind of tempted to have that wait until after the midterm, and so I may in fact just, I want to see how things go here. The other way to do things is actually with more scoping puzzles. So let's see how this week goes. Oh, that's what I wanted to bring up here is assignment one. Okay. So what I'd prefer before starting to talk, I don't want to just go through all the answers. You all can read the answers. I'd like to know which questions did you find presented you with some difficulties that you thought were a little confusing or hard. Yes? This one, so the submit screen show all the results for past records. Okay, yeah, that I'm happy to go through. That one's a little trickier. And then any other ones? Yes.
Actually, about the same one, I got the arrays and things to send through. Okay, and display it, but I don't know what exactly it was or where I actually put the functions that would update the arrays. Because what would happen is I would submit and nothing would show up. And then when I would enter the second data, I would hit submit. The first set of data would show up. Then when I entered the third, first and second would show up. It was always one behind. So I'm not sure why that is.
I have an idea of that. we can talk about that, and I'll give you my hypothesis for that. Other? We'll just start talking about this one. So the application listed on port 3200, if you didn't do that, I don't know what you're doing. the home button, we talked about last time, that was just that you either use a null form or you styled the link or use a little JavaScript. That was pretty straightforward. Add the phone field, that was just, you have to go through the three files and just add them in the right place. The last one there is a little, there we go. So you can see here, you have to add it to the views index.jade, routes index.jade, views add.jade, but this is the one that's a little more interesting. So, what do you have to do to get this to show a record? So you have to first modify routes index to keep an array of the JavaScript objects. So you got to, that you need. Then in the export.add function there, push the new elements of this array on and pass this list as a of JS objects into the render call. and then display it. So you don't, the code's really is, you know, pretty simple. You know, you keep your state here. There's only one solution. There's multiple ways of doing this. Keep your state here, define an object with all the fields, push it. Oh, I think there's a typo there. I think that's supposed to be state. You're right, that's correct. So state's there, there's the object, you push the object on state, then you pass state here, items are here, and that's all you do there. The key thing is you want to do this manipulation before you pass it on to your renderer. If you did this all afterwards, you would have seen the behavior you're describing. Because, of course, that's going to render the page. Yes?
Why do you have two titles being sent to it? Like, if you scroll up a bit, there's a title field in the object, and then there's one also in the res render. There's, like, first added twice.
Oh. This will just be ignored. You don't actually need this title here. Yeah, that's not... That can be. That should be. I should delete that. That's not needed at all. Thank you. Yeah. I can bug the TA about that. It's like, why'd you put that in there? Because you'll see it's not used anywhere. Because the main thing is it's not used in here. So you just, what you do is you change the where it prints it out. You just need to make this instead be each item in items, and then that's it. So. So again, that wasn't supposed to be a hard. It was hard in the sense of you had to actually start. You know, you had to know that you had to do this looping in your template. And some of you want to do looping elsewhere, but should I go over any details of this? So, like on the test, what I can ask you is things like what's your general implementation strategy for doing something like this? I wouldn't necessarily want you to write all the code out because this is kind of a pain, but saying what you would need to do some to make a change to some bit of code, I might ask you that. Now, you all got, I assume now understand the whole export.index, export.add, getting converted routes, index and route add. We spent a lot of time talking about it in class. I can go over it some more. I feel like it, but I'm hoping that's clear by now. Yes? Oh, so like, for example, the kind of answer I'd want you to give is something like this, as opposed to this on the test. Because grading handwritten code when you have like, you know, multiple lines and stuff like that is just annoying. It's as annoying to grade as it is for you to write. If not more so. Now this is an important question to understand. When is the anonymous function on line 34 of app.js? So let's switch back here. Line 34 of app.js is this. So this is the anonymous function we're talking about. Oh, nice. So we define a function, the function body has console log, and that's basically all it has is a console log. When is that function called? And who calls it? Yes?
It is called as part of calling app.listen.
Right, so app.listen, the body of it calls this anonymous function.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this...
Well,
what? Mm-hmm. What? No, it's not
the,
creating
it's
it.
It's defined there and it's called there.
No. The caller, you did not create the function app. Listen, you're defining a function on the fly. You could have defined this as another name, and you're passing that function. You're passing a reference to it to app.listen. You're giving it a function. This is a callback function. This is the weird part of doing JavaScript, particularly in a node context, is you see these callbacks all over the place. So if you're writing this in a conventional system in C or C++, typically, what you would have is instead, you'd have a call to app listen, just give it the port number, And then the next line after it, you would call console.log server listening on port whatever. That's not what we have here. Okay, well, first off, what would happen if I did do that? If I just put, I could just put null in here. I don't actually have to pass a function. If I just put null in here and then just put console.log here as the next line, what would happen? Yes?
So the function that we're passing in is actually only executed, I believe, if the server is listening to the port. Because what I did was I changed the port number input. I made it like 1, and it would bring an error, and that statement wouldn't be shown, so that Express server is listening. Whereas if you put it outside, it would run no matter what.
Well, okay, so it'll run no matter what if you put it outside. True. Part of it. Yes?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What it doesn't matter if it's listening or not, it's going to run.
So, yeah, so the basic flow of control you should think of when you see a callback like this is the function is going to run, and when the function finishes, it will call the callback. It's not strictly true for all of them, but in general, the callback is going to be the last thing that's called in that function. So basically what you're telling it to do is run this code after you're finished. And in particular, it's typically after you've finished, either successfully or not successfully. Depending upon the kind of callback, you can potentially the callback can take an error as an option. And if that's the case, it will then potentially do different things and whether there's an error or not. I think this callback is only called if, you know, the port is successfully done. And basically, it gives you then this message. So this isn't that interesting of a callback, but this is the pattern you see in Node all the time. Because, and so why don't we want to have this afterwards? Is this just a quirk? Yes?
If listen failed, you don't want it to tell you that it's listening when it's not?
That's true, but why don't I just have a return value? Like I can see what I would have had is I had an error value that I would check. Now I'd say if there's no error, then log this, otherwise log an error. There's specifically not that kind of sequential logic. We don't finish one go on it. We said pass this function on and say, call this when you're finished. Why is that needed in Node?
Because it's not blocking.
Because it's non-blocking. Because what can happen if you put this afterwards? You'll get this Express server listening on the port that will run before potentially the system is listening. The whole point of the callback is that some sort of input-output is happening inside of the function. That input-output could in principle take a while to finish. So in Node, the way they handle this is rather than block, because this is a single-threaded process. If it blocks on anything, it then isn't doing anything else. And that means that you aren't servicing incoming requests. Now, of course, you're just bringing up the server, so it doesn't matter as much here. But the basic pattern in Node is the callback is there so that you can take a while to do things. This entire file is evaluated and run before the web server is listening. It could, in principle, sit there and do some very complex computations. Could take minutes before it actually starts listening. But this message will only get printed once it's actually listening. So you can put code after here, and it will run after this. That'll be an interesting exercise for you to try, is what should happen, and watch me, when I tell you this and you try it in Node and watch it not do this, and I'll have to figure out exactly why it is, but what should happen is if you put a console log here, it should print first, and then this should print. Of course, there's a race, I have to experiment with that, but in general, that's what should happen. But the main thing is you can't count on sequential operation a lot of times in Node because things are asynchronous. You really need to think of when this event happens, make this handler. So because it takes a while to set an open TCP socket and everything. So now here is when a user types in a value for the name form field, it hits submit and then sees the response page coming containing the characters entered for name. How does the value move about in the form demo code? So there what I was looking for is there's the whole process of how it gets to the web server and the communications and stuff. I wouldn't want you to outline that. I want to know in your code, where is it going? And the first place, there are three places where it is. The first place is, it's in the views index.jade. It gets entered into the form on the client. And so it's the HTML translation of that template that's going to get the data first in the browser. You type it in. And after you type it in, you hit submit. It gets turned into a post request, gets sent to the server. When it gets to the server, your code now is running on Node. What part of your code is going to get that next? It's going to be in routes index.js in the export.add function. Routes.add was how we how we defined the handler, but the code is export.add in this routes index.js. That's the code of that's the code we have for the add post, the handler. And then what it does is it comes into there, and if you look in that function, so let's go back to the code we're talking about. So first place is, so you notice I'm not referring to main at all. Right? I'm not referring to app.js, because this isn't really in the path. This is all setting things up. First we have, this is the first piece that's going to get run, index.jade, because we have the form, we have the submit. Then it will go to add, exports.add, because there's this is what gets called in response to the post. It then gets the request body, which will have, rec body has the name, is what we want. So we get that, we parse it in, we send it off, and then, of course, we call the template add.jade, which gets that information, parses it, turns it into a web page that is then sent back to the client. So that flow of control is what I want you to feel confident about, that movement there. We'll talk in more, as we go through the semester, we'll talk in more depth about the layers underneath, but you should see that basic client, server, client. Because that's how web apps work. Questions? Make sense? Was that question a bit confusing? I don't know. Some people kind of like were interpretation, but
I really thought that one there was a review of what it is that you had discussed in the last class, which was parts of the cookie process and how sessions are put on hold and how you break up a complex part. And I thought that's what the question was.
Well, you can certainly go into more depth. There's a couple of layers down you can go because you could say how the name gets turned into an argument that gets put into the body of the post request and that gets sent and that has to get parsed by the Node code. And because there's a whole bunch of parsing and things that happen. On the browser side, there's huge amounts of code that runs in order to get it onto the wire. And there's huge amounts of code in Node that run before your URL handler gets run. But we haven't talked about that directly, and to some degree, there's always a big stack. I mean, I'm not even talking about all the kernel code that got run on both sides to do things, or the routers that move stuff. I mean, you have to know what abstraction layer to try to understand the system. And I'm saying that you should at least be comfortable working at that, the abstraction layer of the flow of control inside your own code. Not worrying about anyone else's. Assuming everyone else does their job correctly. So, clear? Do I need to go through that in any more detail? So how'd you find, so was assignment one easier than you expect, harder than you expected? Any thoughts? I wasn't trying to make something really hard. I was trying to make something kind of that would at least get you to think a little bit so as to make sure you knew what you were doing. It's trivial that you don't learn anything. But so this one, assignment two, again, there's a bit less time. There's not full 2 weeks, a bit less. We're coming to midterm. I don't want to cover too much additional material before the midterm because I know getting all the bits that we've learned solid in your head, I know there's still some questions. So I really wanted this more to solidify things. So what I've done is you take the session demo, which you played with in the tutorial. You're going to, there's a bunch of questions about how it works. So these questions here, the 2.1, should be pretty easy. This one, so it keeps track of how many times an individual user is logged in. It's a little bit more code. It shouldn't be many lines. The one that's a larger bit is modify the code so that sessions are authenticated with passwords set and stored in clear text. That one should be a little more work. I try to be very specific. Again, it shouldn't be much code. But it will be a little bit more work because you're actually going to have them enter a password, check the password, and things. Now, I will tell you now that the way this is... So one of the things I want to talk about now is why what I'm telling you to implement here is horribly insecure and not at all what you want to do. Because what I'm saying is you enter the password in the browser, it's just going to send it, and the server is just going to store the password. And then it's going to check later if you sent the right password. Now, I say this is horribly insecure, but I know there are web applications that do exactly this in production all over the world, even some very major sites. So in some sense, this is horrible. In another sense, this is common. Huh? What?
Sorry, if you are not exclusive, bad practice and common practice.
Definitely not exclusive. Yep. So that's part A. The other part is puzzle.js. And puzzle.js is this. So you'll notice this is a function that returns an object which has a bunch of functions associated with it as methods. And I want you to tell me what it does. Now, there's a couple of little bits I have not talked about that I want to explain here. First off is this, the REPL part, and this part. So what these are is this is to enable you to just type in node puzzle.js and get a working command line interpreter. So what this allows you to do is, say, read eval print loop is requiring a read eval print loop. So you're just loading that module, and then we're calling REPL start. And so I can specify my own prompt for my read-eval print loop, and I'm specifying this use global true. It's because that way I let the read-eval print loop use the global environment as we do normally, so it basically behaves with respect to global variables as you'd expect. And then this context thing allows you to specify bindings inside of the read-eval print loop. So these are new bindings. So you can look at the documentation of REPL. It's online. It tells you about this. But I strongly encourage you, when you play with this code, to modify it. Do not just play with this version. You need, in order to understand what this code does, you're going to have to make changes and see how that other code works. You're going to have to see what values are visible. I try walking through some of the questions. That's what I'm doing here, is I want you to tell me what these are. But honestly, all these values, if you just want to put down these values, all you have to do is cut and paste this into the puzzle.js, and it will give you the answers. That's all you have to do. Because it's all valid things. But You will be expected to answer similar questions in the midterm without the aid of a computer. So, if you do the cut and paste, and you submit the answers that way, you will do very badly on the test, because this is going to be a good chunk of it. Is understood. I want you to be able to read through this code and figure out what it is. And the only way you're going to do it is by reading it, looking at what it does, changing it, and understanding why it does what it does. And if you don't understand it, you need to ask questions. Because it's not really twisted, but there's a few little bits. And there's one other thing in here I have not talked about. Can anyone spot it? There might be some global variables in here, but that wasn't what I was talking about. I'm talking about this. Return eval of x. What's eval? I talked some about this, the read eval print loop, but what is it? What's it going to do?
I think it takes a chunk of code and just evaluates.
Exactly what it does. So it takes x as a string and treats it as a snippet of JavaScript code. And it evaluates it in the context where it was run. Logically, it's like you type in the code right there. That should seem crazy powerful and a bit scary. It is. So part of this puzzle is understanding what you can do and what you can't do with that eval. And it's interesting to see what the power of it is and the limits of it. Because there are some things you think you can do and you might not, you thought you might be able to do, but you can't. It's very powerful, but it's not all powerful. So that's my exam. So I don't want to go through too much, but those are the things you should know before working on these things. Good. And please assign as a zip, submit as a zip file, because the easiest way to do a lot of these questions is to, the easiest way to do part 6 and 7 is you should modify session demo. And so just submit the modified session demo, but you're going to have an answers text file. In that answers text file, explain what you did to change it. Okay? So now, going back to session demo. No, I'm just going to turn off the screen now. Interesting, you see free written on your board. So what is bad about having, so you have your browser and you have your server. You're going to enter a password here. And you're going to send it to the server. So here, this will be an HTML form. This will be over HTTP, by a post. And the server will process it. And we'll get compare, sent, and stored. First off, before I do this, I can run JavaScript in the client and the server, correct? So, one way I could do this is I could just send the password to the browser and let the browser compare the password that is stored with the password the user entered. Why don't I just have the browser check the password?
It would be in the cookies, and you can just read it if you want.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be in the cookies, but... Yes?
You'd have to know which user that browser was trying to log in as before you sent the password to check against.
Well, you don't want
to send your entire password user set.
Sure. Well, that would probably be too big for a big site. That would be too much data. But you could have something that as the user types in their username, after they switch to the password field, in the background, you could have it fetch the password from the server, bring it down, and wait for the user to type it in, and then do the comparison.
That still has the problem that you're just sending the password probably in the clear over the internet where anyone else...
Okay. So, let's look for places of attack. I'm going to talk about this multiple times throughout this term, but I want to get it really solid so you have a mental model of why things are bad from a security point of view in the context of web applications. So first off, we intercept it here. So sending the password either from the client to the server or the server to the client, you can intercept. So that means anyone's watching your network traffic could just capture it. How do you prevent that from happening? From someone just capturing the password on the wire?
HTTPS.
Yes. So the standard solution for this is HTTPS. So what is HTTPS? We will talk about it in more detail in the second half of the class, but that... Basically, think of it as, you know, PGP SMIME for network traffic. It's digitally signed, encrypted network traffic. The main difference between something like PGP and something like this, HTTPS is that PGP works in batch mode. The whole message is encrypted and signed at once. With this, you're encrypting and signing a stream of data. It's, you know, you have constantly having more. So you have to be able to incrementally update it, and so that changes the kind of protocols. But fundamentally, the guarantees are roughly the same. So let's assume we've got HTTPS. Okay, so that would do that. Now, of course, you did learn about key management. Right. The big problem with any sort of system where you're doing digital signing and encryption is how do you know you have the right key? That's actually a really hard problem. We'll talk about that more later. But assume you have the right key, assume it's signed right, then you've protected against transport. Okay, let's assume we're using HTTPS. So we can send the password in the clear from the client to the server or something. We're safe. But I want to send the password from the server to the client and have the client verify the password and then send the results and saying whether yes or no, and then the server knows, okay, this person logged in or not. Anyone else?
Yes, sir. The user has full access to the JavaScript that's running on their own client, so they could just like adjust that function to say return true, like no check or anything.
Exactly. They could, if you had the password processed on the client side, the user could snoop in the browser and watch the data come in and look at the password and just type it in that way, or they could change the code and type it in, you know, change the code to just return true, and so they doesn't even check the password. It just says they entered the correct password, go ahead and authenticate them.
And it also means that if somebody gets the username, then they just have to try and enter that, and the server will send them the correct password to go with it.
Exactly. So, very, very bad. Very, very bad. Basic rule of thumb, clients never do authentication. You don't have the client do it on its own. It cannot be trusted to vouch for anyone. The server is the only thing you can trust. because the user controls the browser. So we can't send the password here, so we have to send the password to the server. So again, if you send the password in the clear to the server, it's vulnerable. This is why basically every login box you see on the internet should nowadays be protected by HTTPS. Even if the regular web session is not, the login box is. And it is because in order to keep, basically the only reason it's there is to make sure the password is not sent in the clear over the internet. But now it gets to the server. The server is now just storing the password, and you compare it. This is bad, too. Why is it bad?
If someone gets access to the server, they can control the passwords.
So, how many of you have ever used the same password in more than one site? If you don't raise your hand, you're lying. Because I've even done it, and I know better. So, what's a great way to harvest someone's passwords? Well, if you can get someone to sign up for an account on your website and say, give me your email address and your password. And a lot of times people, what they'll do is they'll set the password to be the same as the password for their email account. So you can just give you the password and then you just try it on Gmail or something and you've got their email. Or try it on other websites that maybe use their email address as the login information and you can get their stuff. So now websites know that users do this. And if you're talking about a legitimate website, they're trying to keep the password safe. But then websites get compromised all the time. And so an attacker gets in, they steal the password database, now they have a bunch of passwords that they can go and try using to get into other sites.
Mm-hmm.
Salt password is. Well, salt. So the key thing here is you don't store password hash. Don't store the password in plain text on the server. What you do is you store it using a hash, specifically a cryptographic one-way hash. So you turn the password into a string that is then saved on the server. Now, you don't use that, you can't let the hash be computed here, because then if anyone steals the password database, they could just use the hash to authenticate. So you have to have the hash computed on the server using the plain text password. But you compute the hash, and then you compare that to the stored hash of it. That's the basic strategies you want to, because that way, did Annie explain one-way hash functions, cryptographic hash functions?
No.
I didn't think so. This is a basic building block of digital signatures. And we'll have to talk about this a little more when we talk more about how to do this sort of security stuff. But a one-way hash has the property, well, you all know what hash functions, right? You've seen them when you've done hash tables, which I assume all of you have seen in your data structure class. Correct? Yes? So, a cryptographic hash is a hash, except that it is supposed to be computationally infeasible to generate some document that has the same hash. So let's say I have something A, and I compute the H of A. So I have the hash of A. Now, the one way means that I cannot go from H of A to A prime such that H of A prime equals H of A. So it's saying, I've got some document that hash that has a hash, H of A. I now want to find another document, A prime, that if I compute that hash, it will have the same hash as this one did. This should be infeasible. The only way to do this is I have to start with A, compute the hash, and then I can, then I've got it. I can't take a hash and then reverse it and go back to forming a document. Yeah, this is not great mathematical notation. Fix it, but. So I think I probably have to do a whole lecture on crypto. So that's right. But listen.
When you say hash prime of A equals hash of A, wouldn't that just mean that they both were?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'll do this properly here. So you start with, you have a document A. Okay? And let's say you have a document A and a document B. And so document A, you compute the hash of it, so you get H of A. So you have two documents, you compute the hashes. So the basic property you want with a cryptographic hash function is if these are equal, if the hashes H of A and H of A are equal, then, so if it's equal to H of B, then that implies that's the conclusion you want to be able to draw. Is that if the hashes of two documents are the same, then A equals B. This is actually what I used when I gave you the Lubuntu image, and I also had a hash on the web page. So the idea is that you downloaded the VM image to your machine, and if you computed the hash of it on your own machine and compared it to the hash on the website, you could conclude that you got the image that was from my web page that I had stored on my server. It had not been truncated or modified in transit. You had the same one. That if, because the hashes are equal, thus A is equal to B. Now, this is, strictly speaking, not true. Because almost always when you're computing hashes, of documents of arbitrary size and comparing them, and the size of the hash is only 128 bits, 160 bits, or newer hashes are 256 or 512 bits. Less than 1K of data you're using to stand in for megabytes or even gigabytes or more of data. So just mathematically, you know that there are many, many, many documents, many, many, many files, for which A and B will not be equal, but yet their hashes will be. You know, A and A, this will be false, but this will be true. There exist many documents for this. But in practice, we can do this. We can assume this sort of logic, because it is mathematically infeasible to compute the reverse. If I give you a hash, if I give you the hash of a document, you can't generate a document that has that hash without doing a brute force search, and doing a brute force search through a space of 2 to the 128 or 2 to the 256 or something is not something we're doing with computers anytime soon. Not in this universe. If you can use other universes and quantum and whatever, maybe, but not in this universe. So I'm going to pause there. We'll take 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll start up again.
Setting and rule tables are beyond the scope of this course.
Okay. We can go ahead and get started. So does this... So I had a little question there just before the break about what about rainbow tables? So when people talk about rainbow tables, what they talk about is, okay, you can't, I can't go from arbitrary documents and reverse the hash. But what if I can enumerate the entire space of documents? For larger documents, this is not possible. But if we want to, say, enumerate the space of all 8-character passwords, or 10-character, even 12-character passwords, that is possible. You can just, you know, make up all possible, you know, 10, 12-character passwords, and then compute the hashes of them. And then, once you have this giant table, that's what's called a rainbow table, you could then, you have a hash of a password, you then just look for the equivalent hash and then find the match. And say, oh, that's your password. How do you prevent this? You make the document bigger. That's what salting is. Instead of hashing just the password, you hash the password plus a fixed string. You say, your password plus hello there. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't even have to be secret. It just has to be something that makes the space longer. That means the attacker now, if they want to attack your password database, has to generate the entire big thing, which can be terabytes in size now, using your salt. Using that little hello there in addition to the passwords. So you just made their attack harder. So when they talk about salting passwords, they talk about adding something onto the end of the password which is constant before computing the hash. It's a very quick explanation. I can cover it again. We'll talk about this later, but I'm finding that in talking about web applications, if you don't talk about security, I start feeling silly. So I'll be sticking these things in here in little bits. But now I want to switch tacks, and I want to talk about JavaScript variables. So let's start with a very simple piece of JavaScript code. So what we'll do is we'll say, a equals 5, var b equals 2, and okay, so a very simple piece of code here. We have a equals 5. Oh, I'll put some semicolons in. Although JavaScript isn't that fussy about it. But a equals 5, var b equals 2, and var c equals function with one parameter a, which returns a plus b. So I'm going to try drawing a picture to show what this looks like. And the way I want to do is I'm going to talk about various scopes. So really, every time you think about a symbol you see in JavaScript, it has been defined in an associative array, in a hash table, symbol table, really. In other words, you take this symbol is in some sort of table where you can look up the symbol basically by hashing it, and then you can find out its value. That's how it's implemented on the covers, but here we just know that we have strings, and they have values. So, how many of these are there is the question. And where are they defined? So, one, I will tell you, there is a global. There's a global symbol table. What sort of symbols are inside of this global symbol table? Actually, I'll just make this a little bigger. Let's make this a little bigger. So this is defining associations between symbols and values. What sort of things would you expect to be in the global? Okay, we'll talk about A, B, and C, but like the things we expect there are the things that are available at the command prompt that we haven't defined anywhere else, but things like object, you know, things that kind of come with the system. We expect most of those symbols to be defined in the global environment. Function prototype, object, so function. Now, one thing you should pay attention to is if these are in the global environment, does that mean they can be redefined? Yes. You want to write really twisted JavaScript code, you start redefining things, the global environment, for common identifier things. It just, you can really mess with yourself. Depending on, now, of course, if you start messing with some of these, some implementations might decide to not actually put them in there, but technically, they can be redefined most of the time. So, yeah. So, you got all kinds of standard things. Now, since this A here is being defined, A equals 5. We're also going to have A. Which will be defined as the value 5 in the global environment. Now, is B, where is B defined? Let's assume this is inside of a file. We'll call this foo.js. So one thing that Node does, which isn't quite true in the browser basically you have the global environment, and then you have stuff in your, basically everything that this all kind of goes in the global environment. Node has this notion of variables that are local to a file. So what that means is every time you load a file, you're inside of a file, there is another symbol table, which is really, you could just say it's defined as foo.js. So these are the symbols associated with foo.js. And it's another table. In browser JavaScript, this and this will actually be the same thing, but Node, they are not. So in foo.js, what symbols do we have defined here?
B and C.
B and C, yes. We have B, which is 2, and we have C, which is what? Function. Do we have A here? No. A is not there. A is not defined here. A is here. A is in the global. We do not specify var. Thus it is in the global.
Even for Node?
Anytime you access a symbol, the first time you assign a value to a symbol, if you do not specify var, it goes to the global environment. This is the first time we're defining A. It's not a var thing, so it's going to the global. Yes?
Well, what about the parameter A?
Aha. Uh-huh. Yes.
I found a little trick in there.
So, all that I will tell you now, according to this, the only things that are in foo.js is B and C. B is associated with 2, C is associated with a function object. The function object defines its own scope. But this scope is produced every time the function is run. So when we do this right now, there is no there is no meaning for A when we define this. But now, so now what we'd have to do is we'd have to say C of, you know, let's say 3. So now we're making the call C of 3. So when we make this call, this environment will come up. And in this environment, this is for, you know, so this is for, now it doesn't have a name associated, but so we'll just refer to it as this, you know, associated with this function. And in this environment, we will set A to 3. So you notice we have this scope, and this scope. The global, the one for the file, and the one for this. This is, the global is persistent for as long as the system is running. This is persistent as long as code that's in this file is potentially active and running, or data associated with running. This one is ephemeral and only exists for the duration of the particular call to C. This will be created and then destroyed once this returns. So how do I do symbol resolution? Let's walk through this. So now I enter the function here. I now am creating a new environment. The first thing I have in here is I have an A. Implicitly, when you have an argument, it's a var declaration. We're saying it's var A, and we're saying it's associated with the value, which is whatever we called it with, which is this 3. So that's what sets it up in here. If I had said, instead, var D equals 6, that would put a D 6 in here. But now, when I compute this, A plus B, how do I find the values of A and B? So I start inner out. So I start here and looking for things. Do I have a value for A? Yes, I have a value for A. That's 3. So 3 will get put here. And then I look for B. Is B defined here? No. Is B defined here? Yes. So that will be 2. So it will return the value 5, as expected. But now, if I instead change this parameter to be, say, G, you know, well, let's call it X. So now this is a parameter X. So now my definition here changes to X. So now I compute the same expression, A plus B. Now I look for the value of A. Is there an A here? Nope. Is there an A here? Nope. Pop up to the top level. Is there A here? Yes. 5. So now this is 5. And then same thing for B. We start here. Is B here? Nope. B is here, yes, 2. So this will now return 7. Note, the only thing we changed was the name of this local variable parameter. But it changed the value of things, because otherwise we shadowed a value in an outer scope, in particular the outer, the global scope. By changing the name, we no longer shadowed it. In general, you want to only access variables for which you have defined the value locally. Because otherwise you get into really weird situations like this. It's like, who knows what the value is? Now, if this is local, like for example, let's say we do here, let's change this to X plus D. So now, this is referring to a local parameter here, and this is referring to this. Can I ever change the value of D outside of this? But what if I define D up here? What if I say var D equals something? No, says 2. Okay, would that change its value? How many people say yes? How many people say no? The no's are correct. Because even if I say var, let's say var D equals 2, so what is that? If we put a var D equals 2 there, that will define a D here. But inside the scope, we now have x and d. So here, when we return x plus d, we start our search here, in the innermost scope. We look for x. It's here? Yes. We look for d, here. We never see the d over here. We never see anything that's in the outer scopes. Never see.
What happens if inside of the function, you don't specify the var for d?
Yes, okay, so what if I do not specify this? Then, will it be defined here? Nope. Now, here is a little glitch of JavaScript. The logical thing for this to be is by setting d equals 6 in here, this is correct. This is fine. You set d equals 6. D is previously defined here. So what you would be doing here is setting this to 6. Let's say I just say d. I just want to know the value of d right at this line here. What's the value of d right here?
2.
The value will only change to 6 after this function is called. So if I now call c after this, now that will change the value. And then if I check d afterwards, then it will always be 6 after that point. It's a persistent state. Yes. D is not global, but D is global to this file.
For this function?
No, and for all the code in here for the duration here. I mean, it means that multiple times calling C, calling anything else, this will be persistent. It acts like a global, except it can only be seen within this file. So this is, think of it like a private variable, but it's persistent state. It will be persistent as long as you can access these things.
If d var equals d was 2 was never defined before you access d without the var, would that be global or include that?
What do you think? Global or not? It'll go to global because var says define it in the innermost scope. That's what var says. Define the symbol in the innermost scope. Put it there. If you don't say that, it's just going to look for it in the scopes. Now, the problem with JavaScript, you could say, is that, what you could say is if I got rid of this D line here, and I have this D equals 6, what you might want to do is have it look here for the definition and say, okay, there's no D here. No D here. No D here, and then it goes here, and it says no D here, and it generates an error. That'd be kind of nice. Symbol not defined. You never declared it. Some languages do that. That's not JavaScript. JavaScript, you get up here, and it says, oh, it's not. You haven't defined it yet. I will define it for you. Here you go, D, D equals 6. Here you go. It's like, no, it's a bad idea for lots of reasons. but it's what JavaScript does. If you basically go up the scope chain, go up these environments, you see, is it there? No. Is it there? No. Is it there? No. And when you get to the global, you've bottomed out and everything, and it says, oh, you haven't defined it yet. I'll define it. I'll assign the value there. So repeat, start over, sorry.
We have variable t equals
to 2. C equals 2, okay, yeah.
D is equal to 2, and then we have D is equal to 6 inside the function.
You're saying you have this line back?
Exactly.
But keep the var?
Yes.
So this, if I say var D equals 2, so...
Does it mean that we have two values of D in foo.js?
No, well, so this one gets defined in which scope? What is the scope? What is the innermost scope that's active right here? This is the scope of the file. So this one, so this is what gets D, you know, 6. D equals 2 right now. Now you get into here.